Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. on Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. Tonight we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to a montage of magical worlds before returning us, thankfully, safely, to the present. We are your first-time hosts, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman. We are joining a crowd of supportive and encouraging co-hosts, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton and Greg Audell, whose shows we have always enjoyed so much and who we have been so lucky to meet through storytelling. We are excited to share this Wednesday evening with you. We are also in the capable hands of awesome intern Tatiana Gago, who knows how to work all this stuff and make the show sound great. So, of course, we would love to acknowledge Dr. Hank Rubicek, the founder of this radio adventure, for creating this venue, without which so many people would never have gotten to share their stories. Hi, Dr. Hank, and thanks for this amazing opportunity. Because KPFT is listener-sponsored radio, we'd also like you to consider supporting this type of program by making a financial commitment, no matter how big or small. Any amount can help to ensure that Houston community has the opportunity to enjoy this program or any of the eclectic and unique programs KPFT has to offer today and years into the future. I know that shows like So What's Your Story are great to listen to, whether you're, you know, doing chores at home or in traffic. That's the way I usually listen to the show. So if you have the urge to just go to kpft.org, click donations, and be sure to select So What's Your Story as the program that inspired you, because that's true, right? Thank you in advance. Tonight we have some amazing guests who are here to share their stories with you. Iris Greer Sizemore, Jackson Shaw, Amanda Wenger. They are friends of ours and are truly accomplished people who have unique and exciting lives. Therefore, they have accumulated a host of incredible stories just by being who they are and tackling their day-to-day lives with incredible energy and enthusiasm. It's great to be surrounded by powerful, loving women tonight.
And is that ever true? It seems that today women and their voices have never been more front and center, whether politically, in the business news, or on the breaking edges of technology and science. And as a matter of fact, we got a new female Nobel Prize winner today.
We sure did.
And I just read that the one who got one previously didn't even have a Wikipedia page when she won her Nobel Prize. They had to hastily make one because she wasn't important. Therefore, it's important we're talking about this today. We are fortunate this evening to be in the company of Iris Greer Sizemore, the founder and leader of the Houston Women's Group, a diverse, multi-generational feminist group that has been meeting every week since 1974. She will share with us the story of this group, which is still going strong after 44 years. Also, we are graced with the company of Jackson Shaw, accomplished poet, who is Iris's partner. She will continue the story of the Houston's Women Group from her own perspective. Together, they'll weave a tale of how this group brought their lives together, just as it continues to bring women together in community every Sunday for 44 years. So, Iris, what did you want to say about the Women's Group?
I wanted to talk about what I believe are the five pillars that have contributed to the longevity of this group. Timing, message, space, commitment, and always change. Timing, September 1974. The heady days of the second wave of feminism was sweeping this country and the world. The message, of course, was the personal is political. A few women gathered by the fireplace of the Fannin Street Unitarian Church space. We were discussing Mary Daly's revolutionary book, Beyond God the Father. The title alone was revolutionary. This was the beginning of the longest feminist group, Women Only, meeting weekly, every Sunday at 10:30. No dues, no officers, no committees, no structure. But imported women defining the realities of their life at the same time living in a patriarchal world. I believe that would be the message. The women's group is an incubator for women connecting, questioning, defining, creating, and exploring new paradigms. Once again, reflecting the stories of our life that had never been talked about before. Our members are committed to a form of diversity, including the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, Pantsuit Nation. All are vital to the new feminisms and the new ways of communicating with social media. We include speakers on timely subjects. This past Sunday, Dr. Ann McCoy, if you remember, she ran for HISA school board, was endorsed for the Chronicle, Hope Will Run Again, helped us with her subject, Depression in the Age of Trump. Two Sundays ago, a brilliant young generation, Gen or Tech, Kim Cook, an entrepreneur, shared her journey with us. Many members in our book, in our group, have written books. Susan Yarborough, Bench Press, Dr. Lucy Faltz, Playing with Difference, Stephanie Betts, Essays on Her Days in Chicago, and Counselor Denise O'Doherty with her very timely, relevant book, Thriving Through Transition, and Dr. Jackson Shaw, two new books on poetry. We also interface with Lillian Kerr, who has a program, Bird Eyes View, on this station. We have Melissa Betts, Deborah Bell, Nita Cosby, and Dr. Janelle Tortorici, who have brought us into the current social media of communicating our message. You can find us on Facebook, website hwomensgroup.com, email hwomensgroup@gmail.com.
Well, Iris, that's so fascinating. I was wondering, how are you expecting this group to go into the future? What are your hopes? What are your dreams for this group?
Well, for any group, as we know, to grow, there has to be affirmation and inclusion of the younger feminists who have different views of feminisms. We want to bring in more millennial speakers, Generation Techs. This is the way that the group will, I think, continue, by more inclusion and the different forms of social media that we are integrating into to get our message out.
Well, I love hearing about stuff like this because you get frustrated in your day-to-day life and you say, I wish I could do something. And it's really great to hear from someone who saw a need and spent their time and energy to nurture an idea and make it really happen. I mean, this can inspire all of us to decide to take an action in our own lives. And whether it's you want to plant a garden, you want to start a singing meetup, if you want to volunteer somewhere, one person, it shows, you show, that one person can make a difference for so very many other people just by doing what felt right to you.
But it is a group endeavor now.
Oh, I know, but if you hadn't been the one to say, we're going to meet and we're going to have a group, there wouldn't be a place for people to come. So
Thank you.
Really glad you get to share that with us. And it's due to your energy that that group exists today. And we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Jackson Shaw is here to expand on this story of the Houston Women's Group from her own unique vantage point. She is a member of the group, and she is Iris's partner for 30 years. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, happy anniversary.
And congratulations. That's incredible. Really.
Well, I moved to Houston from New Jersey in 1986, and Iris was living in California. So I didn't meet her, but I had heard about her. She was legendary even then for her energy and commitment to women and helping to start this group. But I did find the women's group without Iris, and I started going. And I also found a group called Woman Space, and they rented a house, and they prepared Sunday lunch because the women at the Unitarian Church during women's group meeting wanted to eat lunch somewhere, and they got tired of going to restaurants, I think. So Woman Space had a place, and volunteers would prepare lunch. I also did that. Then we also had a second Friday of the month special event that I organized with two other women, and we had poetry readings, dances, film festivals, musical performances, potlucks, fortune-telling evenings. I did one of the lunches, which was called Flavors of India, a vegetarian feast.
Oh, wow.
And then we had syncopated synergy, and this term reflected at the time the growing Houston reality of diverse women working in harmony. And it was a medley of women's music performed by women. Then we had Ramblings, Reflections, and Rages, a poetry reading by, for, and about women. We had a party honoring the birthday of African-American novelist, folklorist Zora Neale Hurston. We had a Western night where we learned to do the two-step and whatever. I'm not very good at that, so I don't even remember the name of the dance.
But I would have liked to have seen that. That's great.
Break dancing, right? So,
yeah, right. Then in 1988, Iris moved back to Houston, and I met up with her. And I saw firsthand, through a long period of time, but quickly recognized, why the group continued. And that was because of her passion, commitment, and her inclusivity. If a new woman came to the group, you can bet she would call her the next day and welcome her personally and invite her to something else. Oh. So in that way, she nurtured the women who came, and a lot of them stayed and stayed and stayed. Some came and left and came back, but Iris was always there to reach out individually to these women. And I don't know many people who would function the same way. There can't be a president of an organization who would function that same way. And not having a structure and officers and so on and so forth alleviates all the work of keeping that going, and then she could spend her time welcoming women personally. So that was going on, and then we decided to do some consciousness raising. Now, I think Iris was already experienced with that, and I had lived in London for a year in 1974 and led a consciousness-raising group there. So the two of us melded our experiences together and did our consciousness-raising groups for a while. We also had a song dance. Well, this is before Iris, kind of. This is Woman Space, a song dance comedy, which was the opening event for Gay Pride Week, and it was a variety show that I helped coordinate that was sponsored by Woman Space. But then we did fundraising for Sonia Johnson's visit to Houston. And Sonia Johnson was the former Mormon turned radical feminist who had been excommunicated from her church and had written and published such books as From Housewife to Heretic, 1981, Going Out of Our Minds, The Metaphysics of Liberation, 1987, and Wildfire, Igniting the Shevolution, in 1990. She had also been an outspoken supporter of the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, which never did get ratified. During her visit to Houston, she stayed with us, and she held a workshop for women under the auspices of the women's group. There were other spin-offs from the women's group. One was a little group of seven women, I was one, called Pleiades, and we were artists and craftswomen who made things to sell, jewelry and greeting cards and objet d'art and paintings. And so that was fun. We sold those at the women's group and at the church and at other venues that we found. Then there was WAVE, which I unwittingly started, which was Women Against Violence Everywhere.
That's awesome.
Say the acronym one more time.
Women Against Violence Everywhere.
Oh, I'm behind that.
And I wanted to organize a Take Back the Night march. Mm. One time, one march, one deal. But the women I was able to gather to me had a larger vision, as it turned out, and we wound up with this group. And we stood on street corners protesting violent crimes. We drew pictures on the street of women who had been raped in that spot.
Oh,
and
wow.
A couple of women actually copied our ways of doing things and made flyers and posted them around town and actually caught their rapists.
Wow.
Back then.
Whoa.
And this culminated in, it started in about 89 and culminated with a summit on crimes against women sponsored by the city of Houston and its police department. And it was quite a big deal then. So I was proud of that. We also had something, another spinoff of the women's group called Sister Celebration in 1993, which was multicultural performances by women in music, dance, and theater. And we held it at the Heinen Theater at HCC, and it was to benefit the Houston Community College's group called Women in Transition, a support group for non-traditional female students. My own participation in the women's group has included giving presentations on women Nobel Prize winners in literature,
Whoa.
Per se. And they gave the first Nobel Prize in 1901, but a woman didn't get one until 1909. And then most of the 13 out of 114 winners, those 13 women, most of them, eight of them were from 1991. Three or 1991 to current time.
Mm.
So,
oh, my word.
And my current talks are on little known but highly accomplished women in politics, business, science, literature, art, and activism, for example.
The first Sunday of each month, you can hear Dr. Shaw.
Terrific. And that's about my experience and participation and contribution to the women's group.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say, Iris?
Jesus.
Yeah, well, for all the women that are listening that feel they want to participate, and I wish you would have called me when you did all those things in the 80s. If I had been grown up, I would have totally been
in. If you had
been
grown up.
grown up enough for that, I would have been in on all of those activities. They sound so fun.
We had a lot of fun.
God, they really do. So if anyone's listening and they feel like they want to participate and add your voice, if you want to come to the women's group, can you let us know when and where the group meets so they can come?
The group meets at the First Unitarian Universalist Church on Fannin.
5200 Fannin at Southmore.
Yes, in the Museum District.
And what day?
Sunday mornings, 10:30.
Second floor.
And y'all go eat lunch after, right?
Yes.
Yes, mostly do we do.
And so, sometimes take in a movie.
Oh, wow. So that sounds extra fun.
And I will be doing the presentation this coming Sunday on a little-known but highly accomplished woman. Actually, two of them.
That's awesome. Well, I have gone to this group myself, and I will say, although I had no expectations, I had never been to a feminist group before, I did feel included. And I felt that when
Good.
I spoke, I was heard. And I enjoyed the company of all of the women that were there. They
Right.
were smart. A
yes.
little fiery, some of them, mm-hmm. just like me, okay?
Yes.
Just like y'all.
Yes.
So if you have an inkling to come do this, you should come out and do it. We would be happy to see you there.
Good. Everybody come.
Absolutely. Well, this is Harwood Taylor
women
and
only.
Chris Gorman. Yes, indeed. It's women only, and I will not be there.
I'll go in your place.
Your spirit.
But they are all welcome. This is Harwood Taylor with Chris Gorman and Tatiana Gago on the boards. And you are listening to stories from guest tellers Iris Greer Sizemore, Jackson Shaw, and Amanda Wenger, only on So What's Your Story on Pacifica, KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, also 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. Tatiana, we know this is a big part of the Houston thriving storytelling community, but we're not alone, right?
We are never alone, Harwood. And the best place to start is with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. That's located at Temple Emanuel, 1500 Sunset. The Guild has some seasonal events that are coming up, and since it's spooky season, it's October.
Ooh.
I can finally say that now. like Skyline Screamers, which is on Saturday, October 20th, and that is from 7 to 9 p.m. at Marmion Park, which is located at 18th and Heights Boulevard. And be sure to bring chairs and blankets to hide under. We can't talk price on KPFT, but we don't have to because this event is free. As in no money, none.
Thanks, Tatiana.
So we can say that's a cheap date.
Yes, indeed. Very cheap. I know Halloween's a big deal on this program as Hank brings the noisemakers, right? So that's what we were just hearing. I don't want you to be too frightened. It wasn't real, but they are indeed. Next Tuesday, the theme is disguises, masks, impersonations. Yes.
He's talking about the moth, which is next
Maybe
Tuesday.
Maybe even facelift. Who knows?
Yeah, the moth is next Tuesday.
And it all happens at Warehouse Live.
And there's more announcements, Harwood.
Oh, sorry. Bring it.
And on November 17th, the Guild will celebrate Telebration, which is the National Day of Storytelling, at the Black Lab, a Houston institution itself located on Montrose Boulevard. You can get all of their details by visiting the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, please check out all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008. That's 10 years, guys. And they're all listed under the menu, under the radio program menu. And speaking of radio, not owning one is not an excuse for missing our shows because you can listen to a stream live, not only on KPFT.org, but you can on Facebook Live. And please tell us what you think about our show or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And we absolutely promise to get back to you. And you can share our page with your friends, and we'd love it if you like us when you leave.
Cool.
Well, I did want to mention, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Tatiana, because those are important announcements, but the moth, because that's all I can think about. We go to the moth all the time.
It's true.
The moth is next Tuesday.
Woo-hoo.
It's the Halloween moth, which is always extra spooky because moths are scary, too. the topic is disguises. And it's going to be whatever you feel like a disguise could be, what, a mask, a impersonation.
Maybe even a facelift, who knows?
That's going to be at Warehouse Live. You could come and join us. It's $10, so just bring some dough.
And it's always a fun time. And next week, Mary Edgerton will be here with an interesting program. Since we will be it'll be the first day of the Hindu holiday Navaratri, she and her guest, Sneha...
It's Sneha. I saw her the other day.
I know you did. And then you told me how to say the last name, too. Will you tell me
again? Yeah, it's Sneha Desai.
All right.
Sneha She's super Desai. Nice, by the way.
We'll explore the story of the holiday and its meaning. So stay tuned. Well, it's now officially fall. The last few days have been below 90, sort of. And pumpkin spice everything. I've seen this in the grocery store walking through. Everything's on the shelf with pumpkin spice. So... that only means one thing. It's almost Halloween. So the next portion of the program, we're going to help you get in the mood by showcasing some spooky and creepy stories. Amanda Wenger is an ICU pediatric nurse. And just first of all, I want to say thank you for doing that. She is a kind, bright soul and just so glad that she's doing what she does. And I hope I never meet her in a capacity, professional capacity. But she's here tonight to tell a spooky story about her first year as a nursing student. So what's your story?
Oh, thanks, Hartwood, for that introduction. I really hope I don't see any of y'all at work either, or your kids. I guess I just wanted to kind of say that, I mean, nursing school is scary for everyone in general, but I'm going to tell you about one particular incident that illustrates how spooky it was for me specifically. I went to nursing school. I was really excited about it. My first year, I was nervous though, but I got my acceptance letter. I said, yes, I'm going. You know, my family put down some of the money that would hold my spot. And then our nursing school was holding this open house and they invited us all to come and we could go through their state-of-the-art simulation center and sort of get a feel for the space. So I show up, my mom and my dad are there. Bunch of other, you know, seniors in high school are there with their families. We're excited. The faculty start taking us through this simulation center, what they called the Sim Lab. So we go into this big room in the back of the nursing school, and it's like, I almost want to say it's like orphanage style, like long, long, almost big, long hallway with just beds on either side of the room going down the walls, maybe 5 or 6 beds on each side. And in each bed are mannequins. And the faculty informs us that this is where students practice their nursing skills, on these mannequins. And, you know, I'm looking at my parents, and the prospective students are sort of looking at each other, a little confused, maybe a little freaked out, because all of these mannequins are missing limbs. And they've each got a ratty wig on of a different color, and they're sort of askew. And it really looks like this Sim Center was well used and maybe a little bit banged up. On the far end of the room, there was a baker's rack full of just plastic limbs with different sorts of fake wounds on them that the students would practice dressing. So there were arms, there were legs, there were, you know, butts that you could practice sterile technique on. You could practice dressing these wounds. And every mannequin had a little card on the bedside table next to them with a story. So, for example, you know, this is Mr. Smith, and he has a cardiac history. This is Mrs. Jones. She has a diabetic history. But I'm just looking around this room, and I'm looking at these piles of disembodied, wounded limbs. And, you know, I'm looking at how the faculty are showing us that they can take limbs off the mannequins and put new ones on. And it was just it was a little bit freaky. And now, as an adult, I think I can put my finger on why. Because it's not so much that these bodies were different shapes and sizes, because bodies change over time, and it's, you know, there's all sorts of bodies in this world. And that has never bothered me. But generally speaking, you won't meet somebody and find their arm sitting next to them on the table, detached from them. And I think that's really what it was that freaked me out so much. But the faculty were very proud of this facility. And as kind of their big reveal at the end of this tour, they take us back to a room at the back of the facility. And they say, okay, this is what we call Sim Man. And it was a special animatronic robot that could have a pulse and breath sounds. Sim Man had a heartbeat. Sim Man's lips could change color to mimic blue cyanosis that could indicate that he wasn't getting enough oxygen. There was a monitor that could put up vitals for Sim Man. And it was all just a little too weird. So I leave, and I remember very vividly, I'm on the sidewalk with Mom and Dad, and I'm like, guys, I don't know about this. I thought I wanted to do it, and then seeing this just sort of freaked me out. This is sort of a weird experience. It's not really what I thought it was going to be. And my dad says, look, you know, you already secured your spot. You paid the money. Just give it a shot. We know that you wanted to do this. Just give it a try. It might surprise you. Give it a semester. Give it a year. If you don't like it, you can always switch. So I said, all right, okay, I'll do it. I'll go for it. So my first semester was really hard. Nursing school is very challenging for good reason. I mean, you really want to make sure that people know their stuff when they get to go out into the world and practice on real people. So spent a lot of time in the sim lab. And once you are done with your first semester, you are expected to complete a practical exam at the beginning of each subsequent semester. So January rolls around, I'm frantically practicing and studying to demonstrate certain nursing skills that I will be tested on at the beginning of the semester. And if you don't pass the first time, you get one more do-over and then you're out. You're done with the program. So high stakes. Lots of us were, you know, arriving prior to the start of the semester to be in the sim lab for open practice hours, just, you know, priming tubing, packing fake wounds, skills that now to me as a professional nurse are not that tough. And I look back and I sort of laugh a little bit, like, why was that freaking me out? But at the time, you know, the stakes were pretty high. So, and you could tell how desperate someone was by how long they were spending practicing in the sim lab and how late they were staying there. And, you know, this is January, and this was in the North, this was in the Midwest. And so, you know, January in the Midwest, it's getting dark, you know, it's dark by 5 p.m. So I'm, you know, I'm back there, I'm terrified that I'm going to fail. So I find myself practicing so late that I'm in the sim lab at the tail end of open hours, everyone else is gone.
Oh boy.
So I'm just in this room with these mannequins, and they've got these sort of grimaces where their eyes are closed. They're all wearing the same face, identical faces, and their mouths are open in this half smile, half grimace. And I learned later that they're all of these mannequins' faces, and in general, most medical and CPR mannequins, their faces are molded on the death mask of a young woman who was found drowned in the Seine at the end of the 1800s in France. And someone took a death mask of this young woman, and somehow it ended up being used as a template for all of these CPR mannequins. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm in this room with all these identically faced mannequins, and I'm frantically trying to remember how to prime IV tubing without getting any air bubbles in it. And I'm like, oh, shoot, I'm out of saline. I got to get another bag of saline. I got to keep practicing. We're out of saline. But I think, aha, sometimes we keep extra supplies in the back room. And that's where Sim Man lives. And usually it is locked, but sometimes it is not. And sometimes in the cabinets I can find extra supplies. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go back there. I'm going to grab the saline, come back in. Done. It's unlocked. The lights are on. I think I'm in luck. I go back to the cabinets at the far end of the room, start to open them, and Sim Man coughs behind me. And I'm done. I'm out of there. I am like, nope. I guess I'll just fail this semester. That's fine. Bye. I'm not going to say that I ran. I'm going to say I power walked briskly from Sim Man's presence. And on my way out the door, I, thank goodness, run into some faculty members who were like, oh, you were just coming from the Sim. Well, we were just back there, you know, practicing with Sim Man. And so I learned from them that they had just been back there practicing for a simulation that they were going to run in the morning with some of the older students. So they had been back there manipulating Sim Man's vital signs and making him cough. Because there's a glass, there's a one-way mirror there, and the nursing professors can stand behind the glass and manipulate the vitals on the mannequin via computer. So that's what they had been doing, and they didn't expect me to come in at that moment. My. So they didn't, you know, expect to freak me out, but whew, so
scary.
Yeah. So, but you know what? I gotta say, I powered through it. The rest of nursing school went better after I got over that initial hump. And now I'm doing it professionally. Gosh, it's been over 4 years, and I'm loving it. And so I guess I gotta say, the things that used to scare me, not just about mannequins, but about nursing in general, have really resolved. And the irony is that now I am a CPR instructor, and so I run into these mannequins frequently. They're almost like old friends. And every time I teach a class, it's like seeing a familiar face. So that's my story. That's
my word. That was wonderful. So you have saved the lives of many mannequins now.
I've never had any people. Complaints. I'll say that.
I would have freaked out. I mean, I would never look at one of those CPR dummies in the same way again. I will be watching them like a hawk whenever I'm around them now. So that was a great story. We had mentioned Skyline Screamers earlier, and Chris has a super creepy story from a few years ago. And man, I don't want to just skip over that. Seriously, that is one of the creepiest stories. I hope you tell it at the Moth at some point. I can't even look at mannequins in windows that have style clothes on them the same way after I heard that story.
Yeah, and that part about all the mannequins having the same face, I feel like I knew that instinctually, but I did not know the actuality of it, and now I'm creeped out so
no
much
kidding.
More. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks for the long-term creep feelings.
Yeah, thank you.
So anyway, back to Skyline Screamers. Chris and I have both participated in that, and Chris told a story a couple of years ago that's just one of my favorite fairy tales. It's a Hans Christian Andersen story, and would you share that with us, Chris, tonight?
I haven't told it in a long time, and I'll give it a try. I wanted to tell a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale because my mother is Danish, and we have to represent for the Danish people. It's not just pastries and furniture, just telling you. And this is maybe not a really well-known fairy tale because it's kind of awful, but now I will tell it. It's why you don't tell it to your kids, okay? It's called The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf by Hans Christian Andersen. Okay. A long time ago, there was a little girl, and her name was Inga. And she might have been the most beautiful and adorable little child that was ever born, but you could say that as adorable as she was just as awful. She just had a bad personality. Her favorite activity as a little girl was catching insects from the air and ripping off their wings, and then watching them scuttle around on the floor going, "Look, they're looking for their wings." She thought that was hilarious. Her mother, she lived with her mother, and they were really super poor. Her mother had spent a lot of time doing the laundry and hanging it out on the line to dry. And Inga thought it would be super funny to pull down all the clothes from the line and stomp on them with her boots because she wanted to see her boot prints in the mud. And her mother came back and was in despair. She said, "Inga, you've trampled on my aprons, and I feel that someday you will also trample upon my heart." Inga didn't care. They were super poor, so Inga's mother had found her a job boarding with a family in a town down the road. The woman who employed her had a daughter that was the same age as Inga and just really needed some help around the house. But the woman who was her boss was super nice to her. She really felt it was important that every time she bought something for her daughter, she'd buy something just as nice for Inga. She didn't even make Inga work very hard. But Inga was not grateful for her employer's great treatment. She just felt like she was just getting the things she had always deserved. Okay? So she was having a grand time living with this family, and the mother of the household came to Inga and said, "Inga, you haven't seen your mother in so long, and we've just made this delicious bread. Won't you carry a loaf of this bread to your mother, Inga? I know she misses you so much." Inga was grudgingly taking the bread and was like, "All right, okay, whatever." So she made out to go back to her mother's house, and as she got near the town where she used to live, she saw her mother in the forest picking up sticks, because that was her job. And as soon as she saw her mother, she turned around and left because she was embarrassed. She didn't want to be around anyone that was picking up sticks, because she was better than that. So she went back to her employer's house, and she just told the mother of the family that her mother wasn't home. So another big chunk of time went by, and her employer came to Inga and said, "Inga, we've made another batch of that wonderful bread. Wouldn't your mother want a loaf of this bread? It's been such a hard winter. You haven't seen your mother in so long. I know she misses you terribly." But this time, Inga was prepared. She went and picked out her prettiest dress and her shiniest shoes because she wanted everyone in the town to see her fine things. And she grabbed the loaf of bread and went to go see her mother. Well, there was a marsh where she had to cross in order to get to her mother's house. And it was fall, so there was a mist rising from the marsh. And in the fall, when there's mist coming from the marsh, it only means one thing. It means that the marsh witch is down there brewing. And you know what the marsh witch brews? She brews up trouble. She makes up lies about friends and gossipy stories. And she saw Inga approaching her marsh. And Inga was in dismay. She did not want to get mud on her shiny new shoes. She hatched a plan. She threw down that bread, and she was going to use it as a stepping stone over the mud. And she threw down the bread, and as soon as her foot touched the bread, the marsh witch sucked her down through the mud, through the marsh, down to her lair, to her brewery where she was brewing up trouble. And it turns out that the marsh witch, her cousin is the devil. So she was down there, and Inga was so upset. It was so unpleasant. Her feet were attached to this bread, and she couldn't move at all. She was cold, and she just couldn't move. She was stiff like a statue. And when the devil came to visit his cousin, the witch, he was looking for some decorations for hell. So he thought that Inga might make a good statue to put in his foyer. Inga was super happy about that at first, because she thought about all the people that would walk past her going into hell. She just wanted people to see her pretty dress. But she didn't realize that when she got sucked down through the mud and the muck and the mire, her yellow dress wasn't yellow anymore. It was green with mold and slime. And in the ringlets of her beautiful hair, there were little snakes. And under each ruffle of her dress, there was a little hopping frog. So Inga wasn't looking as great as she thought she was. But she did have a lot of company down there in hell. And what was worse, she could hear people on earth talking about her, which she loved, because she loved hearing the sound of her own name. But then she heard what they were saying about her, People were saying stuff like, don't end up like Inga. You should listen to your mother. Don't do what Inga did. You'll end up in hell just like Inga. And the worst thing she heard was Inga got exactly what she deserved. So much time passed, years and years, and her mother got really old. And she knew her mother was about to die, and she could hear her mother saying, oh, Inga. She was crying and saying, I always thought you might come to no good. And the tears from her mother's eyes fell down through the muck, through the mire, and they hit Inga's face. But they didn't soothe her, because disappointed mother's tears always burn. And they burned Inga like fire. So she's still stuck there. She's cold. It's unpleasant. And all the people that she knew on Earth had passed away, except for this one woman who, when she was a little girl, turned to her mother and said, Inga, I heard she went to hell. And her mother was like, yes, Inga's in hell. And as a little girl, she had asked her mother, if I give all my toys, do you think they'll let her come back to Earth? It just seems so sad that Inga went to hell. I would give all my toys if she could come up and play with me. Well, this little girl now was an old, old lady, and she was about to die, and the Lord had called to her and said, you know, I'm about to end your life. And she goes, I've had a great life, Lord. Thank you so much for our wonderful life here on Earth, but I have this one concern. I just keep thinking about Inga. Is Inga still in hell, Lord? And the Lord's like, oh, yes, Inga's still in hell. And she's like, I just think that's so awful. She's been there so long, Lord. Can't you let her come back up to Earth? It just doesn't seem fair to keep a little girl like that in hell. And the Lord's like, well, she got what she deserved. And the woman, as she's dying, says, Lord, I have made so many mistakes in my life. I have done so many wrong things, but each time you have forgiven me for everything I've done wrong. Can't you forgive Inga? She was just a little girl. And as she said that, the old woman died, and the Lord ascended her to heaven, and she became an angel. And she was crying on her way up to heaven over Inga, and the tears fell from her eyes. They fell through the mud and the muck, and as soon as they touched Inga's face, Inga was instantly released from her paralysis, and she became a small brown bird. And Inga flew directly up out of hell. But she had never been a bird before, and the world seemed frightening. So she just went and hid between the stones in a stone fence, and she looked out at the world, and it just seemed so big and beautiful to her. It was as if when she was a child, she never looked around. But it was a cold winter, and she eventually had to go out to find some food. There wasn't much food to be found for people or animals. And every time Inga, as a small brown bird, found anything, a half-eaten corn cob, a crust of bread in the street, she'd just take one crumb, and then she'd go tell all the other animals where the food was. And as soon as Inga had given away as many crumbs as was in that initial loaf of bread that she wasted, she instantly became a big white bird and ascended straight into heaven.
Oh, that is just fantastic.
Wow, beautiful.
Yay, Chris. Well, I mean, that's just one of my favorite stories ever. Why do you like it so much? There's so many reasons to like it.
Oh, first of all, it's just awful. I like that part of it, but I really like the part where it's talking about second chances, because I can really identify with someone who's made a mistake and it seems unforgivable. And to have the woman petition the Lord for her to say, I've made mistakes too, and you gave me a second chance. To have someone ask for a second chance is so humbling to me, and it's identifiable because I've had to ask for that so many times myself.
Boy, me too. I think we can all relate to needing a second chance. Well, thank you. Halloween ignites family memories for all of us, and I think Dr. Hank might have a memory of his grandfather. Is that right, Hank?
That's right. That's absolutely right. You know, my grandfather was so important to me. But, you know, before I tell you the story, I loved Chris's story. I loved all of your stories tonight. And you know, I loved the dual themes that we're dealing with, too, because, you know, it's not a real weak connection when we talk about the importance of women, and we talk about something fun like Halloween, and we have to realize the seriousness of what we talked about first. And even though that may sound like a stretch, you know, the idea of Hans Christian Andersen, for example, answers so many questions for us. I'd love that story. And it reminded me of Little Match Girl, right?
I'm a
little
fan
Match
of that
Girl
one too.
Yeah, Little Match Girl, absolutely. But it really is stories about problem solving. And even though we don't see a connection between that and the great stories that we heard earlier in the show, there really are some. But Hans Christian Andersen is so great at solving some of these problems. You know, Little Match Girl, the little girl who just sees her grandmother and freezes and goes to heaven with her. And how do you make a story like that so listenable to a child, so relatable to a child? And, you know, how do we take these stories that were so difficult to tell about women and make them relatable to individuals in order to solve problems? There really is a connection. Mm-hmm. You know,
agreed.
Yes. You know, in any event, I wanted, you know, my grandfather, and Halloween really does, yes, just to get back on track, it makes some great, great memories. My grandfather and my grandmother, my mother, they were all from Lithuania. My mother was actually born in Germany, but suffice it to say, none of them celebrated Halloween in concentration camp. It just wasn't a big deal. So when they came to this country, the idea of having Halloween was something brand new to them. It was a whole cultural phenomena. But they knew how much I loved it. And when I was 10 years old, I was really sick and I couldn't go trick-or-treating. And it was raining that night, and nobody came to the door. And Halloween was so important to me. It still is. I love Halloween. I'm always at Walgreens to get the first bag of candy corn at the end of August. Okay. So I was really upset because there weren't any kids coming to the front door. So my grandfather, you know, like he really does this subtly, he gets up as if he has something to do. And about 3 minutes later, there is a knock at the door with a person who pretends to be a child wearing my yellow raincoat. Remember the yellow raincoats that we used to wear as kids?
Yeah.
With the head? And he knocks on the door, and, you know, my mother answers it, knowing that it's him, thinking that I'm somehow going to be fooled. And he says, trick or treat, you know, couldn't quite get it. Trick or treat, I think that's it, trick or treat. And, you know, I knew what he was doing, and obviously he couldn't fool anyone, but that moment was froze it in time. This guy goes out in a storm knocking on a door because I was crying. I couldn't go trick-or-treating. Simple story, I know. But that's my memory of Halloween. That was it.
Beautiful,
it was
Hank.
An incredible. Well, it was just an incredible episode. You know, I always tell stories about my grandfather, and it's actually interesting because he was a man of very few words, but every word meant something.
Yeah,
he was very important to me growing up as a storyteller, and I was wondering what our guests are thinking about when they think about the storyteller in their homes growing up.
Gosh, well, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I just was around tons of storytellers, but my dad was always telling stories. And I just know that I know Jackson's dad was also a storyteller, right?
Yes, jokes and stories.
Well, my dad was a witticisms always and double entendres. And
yes,
it was queer and lots of, I mean, you know, in a good way, sweet. You know, what about you?
Oh, it was probably dinner table competition conversation, because we'd have to come home after school. What did you do at school? And we'd all try to make it
interesting,
as fascinating as possible when it was just mathematics.
Right.
Yeah.
What about you, Iris? Do you have memories? Did you have a storyteller in your family? Not really? All right. How about, I want to know everybody's favorite candy.
Yeah.
Halloween candy.
Roll call.
I mean, I know what Dr. Hanks is. It's got to be candy corn.
Twix.
Oh, it's Twix.
Twix. Oh, it's Twix.
Oh, okay. That's a good one because it's a cookie and a candy. That's double.
My God, you're right.
Yeah. Okay, Iris, favorite candy. I know this is something you got right on the tip of your tongue.
I'll have to go with Dr. Hank. Candy
it's a Twix.
Corn.
Candy corn.
Oh, candy corn. Yeah, but it is traditional.
But the one with the cinnamon part of it, which is hard to find.
Oh.
You're a connoisseur.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Artisanally grown candy corn.
Yes. Jackson?
I didn't really have one, but I was trying to think. I think I liked Three Musketeers and Milky Way.
Oh, those were the good ones to get in that bag of candy, too. I would have stole those, so we would have fought.
I didn't like Snickers at all.
You don't like Snickers?
No.
Crazy. Amanda, roll call.
What's your favorite, Amanda?
Oh, Reese's, for sure. Reese's, that chocolate peanut butter combo.
Yeah,
Still my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I like
that's
that
super
one
super good. Harwood, candy.
You know, any bars, like to me, they always had, you know, those hard candies. Those were just like, that was just garbage. That was just decoration. I wanted a bar, and the bigger bars, the better. Yeah. So like any kind of bar, mogul. I guess Snickers or something like that.
You're a Halloween mogul. You're trying to get the most for the most. Mine is Bit of Honey. I haven't had a bit of honey since I trick-or-treated.
I remember that one.
I still want one today, but I never get it unless I'm trick-or-treating. And they hurt your teeth so much. Oh, ouch.
My favorite candy that they didn't have when I was a kid is gummy bears. I love gummy bears.
I do, too.
Okay. Well, one other thing. Just Amanda has a funny time, a story about the last time she went trick-or-treating. I'm sure it was decades ago, right, Amanda?
Yesterday.
So, okay, here's the thing. I'm not proud of this. I have to say that up front. The last time I went trick-or-treating, I was 23 years old.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, and this is, again, something that my father put me up to, which is wild. Not really. Oh, I got to take the blame for this one. It's not his fault. I had just moved into town. So I did not know anybody around me. And it was Halloween, and I didn't have any plans, and I was bummed, you guys. So I was chatting with my parents on the phone, and I just said, yeah, you know, and I'm kind of near a residential neighborhood, and everybody is decked out for Halloween, and you know, I drove by, and there's like enormous cobwebs covering all these houses, and it just looks so fun, and I just wish I could go trick-or-treating. And my dad goes, why don't you? and I'm like, I don't, he's like, you're short, right? You're like 5 feet tall, they'll never know. And I was like, all right, well, if I'm going to do this. So I get a black dress from my closet, do my hair in pigtails, severe pigtails down each side of my face, and I'm like, Wednesday Addams, right? I can get away with this, right? I get my black boots, I get my black umbrella. I'm like frantically Googling, like, what does she wear? What does she look like? And
this is great.
And I remember it was a nice night. It was a little damp on the street. I think it maybe had rained a little bit earlier, because you know, in Houston the storms are sort of transient and the showers will come and they'll go. And but fortunately it was nice and dry, so I had my umbrella just kind of for show, and I did my face up sort of pale, and I was wearing a little white collared shirt under my dress, so I was like, yeah, Wednesday Addams, I got this. So I start walking through these neighborhoods, and there's all these kids, and it was just sort of fun to remember being that age. It was just sort of fun to remember, you know, wearing all the little like costumes from, you know, from the big box stores with
absolutely.
Like the little chintzy fabric and the tulle. Everyone's in tulle, and the adults are, you know, just sort of wearing scary masks. A lot of the dads are wearing like ghastly, gory masks, and just going up to these houses was such a treat, because, you know, it was, you would open the, you'd say trick or treat, and the door would open, and it was like this full on animatronic experience with like the,
wow.
You know, the music and the, some people had like, I was like, where are these dry ice machines that these people are keeping? Like, what are, how much money are people investing in the giant spiders on the lawn? And,
wow.
And you know, every once in a while, someone would have some sort of, some piece of like, you know, motion sensor, festive decoration, so you'd walk by and a hand would spring out of the lawn like a sound effect, like rawr! And so I'm walking through this just like totally reliving my childhood, like, man, I wish my sister was here, I wish all our friends was here, this is great, this is just what I needed, and I was so lonely and I don't know anybody, but that's okay, because I'm like taking this literal walk down memory lane, and I'm in front of this house and I'm just living this, and somebody looks right at me and goes, hey, how old are you? And I'm like, oh no, I've been caught. And I just go, 14, bye.
Use your high voice.
Trick or treat, bye. And just you know, power walked it down the street.
That's so funny.
So that was the last time I went trick or treating. And it was, I got a little bit of candy. It wasn't even for the candy, you know, it was just for the fun of it. But I do think that's going to go down in history as my very last time.
I don't know if you, that's just so funny. And I'm so glad you did that. It makes me want to go trick or treating.
Inspired to go.
I'm ready to go. Let's all go.
Let's all go.
They're going to kick us out of their neighborhood.
How
but
old
we'll
are
go.
You? I have this memory of the Addams Family movie, one of them, I think it was. And, you know, it's Halloween. It's the Addams Family. And they look at Wednesday and they say, well, Wednesday, aren't you going to go trick-or-treating? And she said, yes, I am. You know, she's always deadpan-faced. And well, aren't you going to put on a costume? She said, I have it on now. And she said, but you don't have a costume on. She says, I'm a homicidal maniac. They look like everybody else. Like, yeah. Anyway, yeah, I remember her also saying the thing about Girl Scout cookies. Are they made of real Girl Scouts?
Real, you know, Girl Scouts. Yeah. I remember that, boy, too.
Yucky. So anybody else have any good costumes that they, favorite costumes they had over the years with our last few minutes here on the show?
I dressed up as an Eskimo bunny and went trick-or-treating at 18 in high school.
Cool. Yeah.
That was my last time trick-or-treating. I had no shame.
I love it.
Did you get a lot of candy?
No, they knew how old I was.
Dang, they shouldn't have checked
your ID.
I was
caught, too. Yeah. They're like, you look a little too old for this.
That's when you just say, 14, bye. Trick-or-treat, bye. I went trick-or-treating in the Midwest. You know, it was real cold up there. So whatever you wore, you had to buy like two sizes too big. Right. And when you're like 10, that's such a buzzkill, because your parents are like, no, you've got to wear like two layers of sweaters and one layer of parka and then your scarf. And you're like,
overweight skeleton.
I'm like, I don't even look like Cinderella anymore. Like, look like the pumpkin.
That's so funny.
Well. Guys, I don't know what my favorite was. I just, you know, it was probably Batman or something like that. Just the fact that you could have a cape on, you know, as a young boy.
Oh, I had a cape too, Zorro.
Oh, boy. Oh,
Zorro.
Boy. Oh, Zorro.
And
cool.
I had a stick. Zorro. It was not a sword. It was a stick, and I was super happy with it.
Well, all right. Well, we've had a really great time tonight. All of our tellers, thank you so much, Iris, for inspiring us all. So that's our show for tonight. Stay put, because the very cool and very new Flash Gordon Parks is up next. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just hanging out, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? Just keep enjoying great stories, or come on and tell a great story about your life. This is Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, along with Tatiana Gago and the rest of the So What's Your Story team, and we want to remind you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.